It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done.
Here, 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 here we go. They say that losses make you grow. If you never knew that, now you know. Investing is about lessons and principles. Never get too high or too low. Playing the long game can be kinda slow. Patience is a virtue, and for what it's worth, assets flying to the moon usually come back to earth. Yesterday's fashions often run out of style. New leaders take over the runway for a while. It's called sector rotation. You gotta learn how to dance. Lace up your capizios, tighten up your pants. One step, two step, three steps, four. Shake, shake, shake those hips. Bring that booty to the floor. It's about getting funky. Shimmy, shimmy, hell yes. Show us what you got on the Investopedia Express. Welcome back and welcome aboard. And what was that we just felt? Keep it together, Bonnie Tyler, because that was a little bit of a turnaround in the stock market last week. Coming off its worst week all year, the S&P 500 found some support last week and ripped to its best rally since October of 2023. And it was the mega-cap tech and consumer discretionary stocks that led the way following earnings reports from Tesla, Microsoft, and Apple that investors decided that they kind of liked. They liked them even more than they might not have liked some potentially troubling economic data that showed that the U.S. economy grew a lot slower than forecast in the first quarter, according to the first estimate of GDP. Gross domestic product in the U.S. fell from 3.4% in the fourth quarter of last year to just 1.6%, according to the Commerce Department, and the latest PCE index reading told us what we already know. Inflation is stuck around 3.8%. That soft landing the Fed was trying to engineer hit some turbulence, and bond yields responded, popping as high as 4.7% midweek, sending stocks south. But investors were looking for reasons to believe, and they decided that their old favorite stocks had fallen far enough, and their future earnings outlooks are pretty strong. For the week, the Dow rose 0.7%. It's up about 1.5% so far this year. The S&P 500 popped 2.7%. It's up 7% year-to-date, and the NASDAQ let it rip, rising 4% on the week, and it's up 6% so far this year. So, was that the bottom? A reversal of the correction that started at the beginning of April? Or was that just a relief rally after some pretty intense overselling? In fact, more than half of the stocks in the S&P 500 hit year-to-date lows last week before this little turnaround. That was the most since March of 2023 when the bank failures began. The S&P 500 had fallen below its 50-day moving average for the first time since November of last year. That ended the longest uptrend in the stock market, 162 days, since the year 1950. And that leads us straight into our big three for the week. Chocolate. Number one, where'd everybody go? Retail investors like us took an extended vacation in April, according to Vanda Research, with the weakest inflows into stocks since the bear market days of 2022. U.S. households own about 34% of the stock market through retirement plans and brokerage accounts, and most of that ownership is passive. But we do account for about 20% of the trading, so when we take a break, the stock market feels it. To be sure, some of that sidelining may have had something to do with the fact that April's tax season and a lot of our discretionary funds go to Uncle Sam. That's seasonality at play. But we also got a little scared this month as geopolitical tensions got tighter, the Fed sounded a little more hawkish, and those rising bond yields are like kryptonite for investors. The Investopedia Anxiety Index started flashing red around market anxiety and personal finance. The CNN Fear and Greed Index shifted firmly into fear after being in the greed zone all year, and the AAII Sentiment Survey flipped to two-thirds bearish or neutral. That was a swift shift in sentiment, and we decided to sit on our hands until last week. Number two, private equity investors must feel like they're in Jean-Paul Sartre's 1944 existentialist classic, No Exit. According to data from Preqin, in the first quarter of this year, the value of global private equity-backed exits sank to its lowest levels in 3 years. No one is cashing out or exiting their private placements through an IPO or an acquisition. Deal flow has slowed to a crawl, and you need deal flow and exits for private investors to get excited. High interest rates have gummed up the funding and the exit pipelines, as these private equity deals require a lot of debt, and when interest rates are high, debt becomes more expensive and less attractive than public stocks or risk-free returns like money markets. Not only was the first quarter super slow for private equity exits, it was also the slowest quarter for initial public offerings since the COVID lockdown days of 2020. If you're looking for more reasons why investors want lower interest rates, look at the exit signs. Almost no one is going out until those rates come down. And number three, Market watchers can't help but look for parallels with other years in history, and lately, the year 1973 keeps popping up in commentaries and conversations. The war in Israel and fears that it could metastasize into a broader conflict with Iran and the entire Middle East, plus the ongoing war in Ukraine, all have the potential to create an oil shock reminiscent of the Yom Kippur War in 1973, also known as the Ramadan War. It was the fourth conflict between Israel and its neighbors, and in this case, Egypt invaded Israel during the holiest days of the year for Jews and Muslims. Oil prices quadrupled from $3 per barrel to $12 per barrel, leading to gas lines in the U.S. and an extreme bout of inflation that propagated into a recession throughout the mid-1970s. The stock market fell more than 30% over the next 12 months. While there are similarities to 1973, we have yet to see oil prices go on that kind of run reminiscent of that one 50 years ago. Crude oil prices did rise 20% in April following Iran's attempted drone strikes on April 13th, but they've settled just north of $80 per barrel for now. In a worst-case scenario, i.e., some version of World War III breaking out in the Middle East, B of A strategists think crude prices could top $150 a barrel, and inflation could come roaring back just as the U.S. economy is weakening. But that would be the extreme case. And while it's always good to plan backwards from a worst-case scenario, geopolitical dynamics are very different today than they were 50 years ago, even though some of the actors may be the same. Let's get set up for a really busy week ahead, and we'll get a double dose of macro data with the Fed's meeting on interest rates this Tuesday and Wednesday, and the April jobs report on Friday. We know the Fed is not touching interest rates at this meeting, and probably not in June or July either. But that GDP report for the first quarter that showed that growth was basically cut in half had to get the central bank's attention. A lot of that slowdown was due to a pullback in discretionary consumer spending, less Beyonce and Tay-Tay concerts, vacation travel, and big ticket purchases. But inflation, clocking in at that 3.8% annual rate, cannot be ignored. The Fed wants that to come down, but it's kind of been in that range for several months, and it's starting to affect our spending. Consumer spending is 70% of GDP, and if lowering rates juices spending, the Fed may turn a little bit more dovish at this week's meeting. Earnings have been the catalyst for the rebound in the stock market over the past few days, and we'll see if that trend continues this week. About three quarters of S&P 500 companies have reported earnings that have come in better than expectations, which is in line with the 10-year average, according to FactSet. And while corporate profits have only grown by 0.5% on a year-over-year basis, earnings have positively surprised by 7.8% so far this quarter, slightly higher than the 10-year average. Widely held companies, including Apple, Amazon, Starbucks, Coca-Cola, and McDonald's, all report results this week. And if you want more details on what we're spending our money on, you're going to hear it in the results coming from these consumer-facing companies all week long. And is that Valhalla we see on the horizon? It's Viking Holdings. The California-based cruise operator is braving the choppy seas of the public markets this week and heading for an IPO. It's attempting to raise $1.1 billion in an initial public offering on the New York Stock Exchange this week, one of the most high-profile debuts we've seen in a minute. We'll see if anyone wants to get on board. In the rodeo that is capital markets, it's easy running with the bulls. The herd mentality is part of our DNA, but there are some market participants who are willing to stop in their tracks when they smell something sour and start digging through the details until they find enough evidence to convince them that something is very, very wrong. They are the short sellers willing to take an evidence-based approach to exposing those wrongs and actively betting against those stocks. They might not get invited to the holiday parties every year, but they are a necessary part of our capital markets, and oftentimes, they'll be the first to identify fraud, deceptive accounting, and fundamental problems that can take a stock from hero to zero in short order. Muddy Waters is one of the pioneers of this kind of research. Since 2010, the company has been digging through corporate filings, balance sheets, and channel checks to uncover the mistakes, the fibs, the lies, and the overstatements companies sometimes make to prop up their share prices. And Carson Block has been leading this firm through that mud since the beginning, and he's our special guest this week on The Express. Welcome. So good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to be here, Caleb.
I want to get into some of the areas that you've been flagging lately through your research. We'll get into that, but I'd love to get into the origin story of Muddy Waters and what brought you to this side of the fence.
Well, disillusionment with the other side of the fence, I suppose. I grew up in the markets. So my father was an equity analyst and he started teaching me about investing at a very young age. And once I figured out that I was not going to be a professional baseball player, I realized that I did want to work on Wall Street someday. And a little while after college and after a stint in investment banking, I was working with my father covering microcap US-centric equities. And this was 99 through 02. And yes, there was the internet bubble there at that time, but we avoided those stocks. However, we realized, or I realized anyway, that we were being misled, if not outright lied to repeatedly by management. And one of the companies that my father had followed for over 4 years and thought he was on great terms with the CFO was a company called Rentway, which was ultimately adjudicated to have been a fraud. And that CFO went to prison for several years. So at the same time that this was happening, because people might say, well, that's microcaps, the largest companies in the world were blowing up in accounting scandals. That's Enron, WorldCom, HealthSouth, Adelphia, etc. And it was a very disillusioning time for me because I realized that as much as I wanted to be an investor, I just hated being dependent on people who have these short-term incentives to investors to pump their stock prices so they can unload stock. So I left the markets at that point. I thought it was going to be a short-term exit to go to law school, looking for more tools to put in my tool belt. But it took me back to China. That was my second stint in China, where I worked as a lawyer and then founded the first self-storage business in mainland China. And at some point, I'd been out of the markets for almost 9 years, and my father got really interested in these Chinese companies that had listed in the US via reverse merger. He asked me to take a look at one of them just to help him with the diligence. And I really wasn't that interested just because I had my own problems that I was dealing with in terms of my business. But I guess I was seeing the matrix in China at that point. And when I took a look at this first company called Orient Paper, I saw that it was a near total fraud. And I was flabbergasted because I had lost faith in most of the market participants by that point in time, you know, banks and lawyers and, of course, IR firms. But I thought, as do I think the vast majority of investors, that auditors are looking for fraud. Now, I'm not being facetious. What I learned through Orient Paper is that that's not their remit. They're not there looking for fraud. So I saw this thing that was a total fraud, didn't really know what to do about it. I had no money at this point in time, but spent $2,000 on puts and put together a 30-some-odd page report that I sent out to 50 people I'd last been in touch with 9 or 10 years earlier, who probably only, if they remembered me as Bill Block's son. And the report went viral. The next day, the stock was down 55%. And 1 year later, Bloomberg Businessweek named me one of the 50 most influential in global finance with Warren Buffett and Jamie Dimon and Ben Bernanke. So
pretty good list right there.
It really was like winning the lottery. It was an improbable rise. And, you know, after a little while focusing on Chinese companies, I just realized, oh yeah, all those problems I ran into on the long side in the first leg of my career, well, the same dysfunctions that have enabled these empty boxes from China to list in the US, you know, that's really what I ran into the first time around. And those are global dysfunctions. It has to do with mediocrity in the industry and the laziness and overcompensation.
They're not geographically limited, right?
No, as long as there's liquidity and stock borrow, there are going to be people who come to the markets to do things they shouldn't do. Because the way I put it is, you know, the dumb criminals knock over liquor stores. The smart ones, they go to these rivers of money that are called the capital markets.
Yeah, absolutely. So we need people like you rooting around in there, and you publish your research freely, and you're not afraid to defend your positions publicly in the financial media, on X. You're very public about it, and that is a tough place to be. But how do you make money as a business? Do you have a capital management part? Do you take on investors?
So late 2015, we started managing outside capital. So previously, we, with internal capital or with a balance sheet provider, would take short positions in advance of our publications. And now managing outside capital, you know, on behalf of that those funds, we take short positions and publish.
So you got other people investing with you or shorting with you. So let's talk about commercial real estate, where you have a few short positions. You've been pretty vocal about it. Everyone knows we have a commercial real estate problem in this country that was exacerbated by the pandemic and the work from home movement. But is this worse, in your opinion, than anyone has really forecast, but maybe you?
Well, okay, I need to inject some, I guess, humility into this here. I didn't have a strong macro view on CRE before we shorted Blackstone Mortgage Trust, that's BXMT. We're generally not thematic at Muddy Waters. Now, occasionally we'll look in the rearview mirror and say, oh, yeah, it turns out that within this period of time, we did a bunch of shorts in this space and, okay, I guess there was a theme there. We've done a few shorts that are real estate related between, I'd say, November of 22 and, well, December of this past year, 23, and we're still short BXMT, but as well as one of the others. Now, the two others were European real estate developers, and we've been short the credit of those companies. What's going on with those is somewhat different from the BXMT thesis. There's a common thread that I'll get to, but what happened with BXMT, we were approached by a credit investor who'd been looking at CLOs, these collateralized loan obligations. These are debt securities that contain a portion of BXMT's loan book. And they said, yeah, we've looked at these CLOs, and a lot of these borrowers are in serious trouble and it looks like are soon going to be unable to make their interest payments and even refi the loans. So we dove in and we concurred with that thesis. And we felt that this is actually a problem that goes beyond the BXMT's CLOs and implicates its balance sheet. And that's because the company's IR told us that the CLOs are reasonably indicative of the loans on its actual balance sheet. So we published on BXMT, and look, a lot of it is our thesis was focused on office properties. So obviously there's been a big change in working patterns, and probably for some time to come, there's going to be lower demand for office space just because companies don't need as much, since the work from home phenomenon, at least hybrid, is likely here to stay. So that was well known. But the other thing is, there were so many transactions that took place. I mean, even if you go to the period before COVID, things were kind of frothy in the CRE markets. And a number of these properties were trading at negative leverage, basically. The cap rates on them, so the net operating income divided by what they had to pay for the buildings, was lower than the cost of the borrowings. So that was a phenomenon, and that's especially true on the residential side for multi-unit family residential. But that was a factor in 18-19. Then COVID hit. You got all this monetary stimulus crammed into the system, and asset values skyrocketed while the cap rates compressed. And there were a lot of transactions done in those heady days. And so the real estate investors borrowed money, when it was LIBOR at the time, it's now SOFR, it's the benchmark rate, was literally just about zero. It was maybe 4 basis points. And what happened in 22 is SOFR went way up as the Fed realized that it needed to fight inflation, and it jacked up short-term rates. So SOFR is now, I think, north of 5%. So that's a 500 plus basis point rise in interest rates. And these loans, after 3 years, basically, the borrowers are exposed to floating interest rates. And a lot of these properties, these office properties, well, again, there's been this secular change in how much office space is in demand. And so the revenue of these properties is down. OpEx of these properties is up because of inflation, and the cost of servicing the debt is up. So a lot of these properties, the borrowers are underwater. Now, we published on that with respect to the office market. We didn't really think about the residential market, but After initially publishing on BXMT, we've come to talk to some real estate investors, some commercial real estate investors who are quite sharp and are focused on the multifamily side of CRE. And they've said, yeah, this is the other shoe to drop, especially Sunbelt multifamily. You know, as they said there, you can always get occupancy up in multifamily, but it's just a question of how low you have to drop the rents. So that is something that it'll be interesting, but you know, we haven't run our own analyses on this, but I do think that that's really something that still hasn't gotten that much attention is it's not just an office story. There's probably a multifamily residential story, at least in the Sun Belt, and that can hurt regional banks significantly. So the knock-on effects of this could be reasonably important.
Yeah, they say the Fed raises rates until something breaks. We saw what happened with some of the banks last year, and now we're seeing that ripple through commercial real estate and potentially residential real estate. All right, so your research, you just laid out a huge case basically again on that sector. This is this combination, right, of forensic accounting that you do, fraud detection potentially writ large, channel checks, and other methods. So what is the process when you smell something fishy? You talked about people bringing you things to look at. Is there anything that you are just flipping through that you're looking at that makes the bells go off in your head?
Sure. And Caleb, I'd like to go back just to a comment you made a moment ago about how they say the Fed raises rates till something breaks. The corollary or the important thing to keep in mind there is that the lower rates are for the longer period of time, the more fragile everything gets. So that when rates are pushed up, the faster things break and the more profoundly they break. So I think that's also what people have to keep in mind when they think about the quote, emergency monetary policy that had been in place for about 14 years before rates went up. As far as how we identify companies that are interesting, I mean, it's really a range of things. And I frequently talk with people and they're surprised to learn that we don't screen. So we're not usually running screens to look for metrics that seem out of place because in my experience, we get a lot of false negatives and false positives because there's so much context that you really need to understand to figure out whether a metric being out of line is significant. But a lot of what we do is really, or what we look for is behavioral. So we're really interested when companies are involved in related party transactions. We're interested when companies that are seemingly profitable are undertaking financings, especially debt financing. Companies that seem to be very promotional or somehow are latching on to the latest trend. So right now, that would be AI. Several years ago, that was cloud or SaaS. So when you see those catchphrases or words suddenly appear in filings and speech of the CEOs, that's something that does get our attention. Another thing that we look for are the Me Toos in a given space. So if you've had a bunch of IPOs in a given space because that space is hot, the first one or two companies, they're probably okay or at least not interesting to us, but number three, four, five companies to go public. Yeah, that's when you start getting the guys who are thinking, okay, I see all this money flowing into this area. So, let me put some lipstick on some pigs and, we'll use the buzz phrase and let's go public. And that's also what gets our attention. We like following individuals who've been involved in stock blowups before, because once you're in crap stock land, nobody respectable is going to hire you.
It's hard to get out.
Yeah, nobody respectable is going to hire you. If somebody hires a person who's been involved in a stock disaster, you'd really have to question the judgment. So yeah, those are some of the things that we do.
I love the behavioral side of it. And I love looking for the catchphrases, especially the buzzwords. You could have put Web3 on that. You could have put cannabis on that. You could put crypto on that. You could put anything. You could have put tulips on that a few centuries ago. So I would love your top three actual BS words or phrases to look for in an SEC filing, other than the big buzzy media catchphrases.
So right now it would be AI or artificial intelligence. A good way to look for that is to compare the present filings to a year ago and see whether there was just a global find and replace. You know, what did they take out in order to drop that in? And if the incidence rate has gone up significantly, it might be onto something. Also love level 3 fair value gains. So it's funny because every now and then I rue the ivory tower academics who promulgate accounting standards because they sit in that ivory tower and they think that everybody who uses GAAP accounting, or in the case of IFRS accounting, is incentivized to be conservative and they want pure information about the economic performance of the business. But when that naivete meets the public markets, level 3 is just a free for all. So when you see a company that's generating a lot of level 3 fair value gains, that's often a red flag. And to be clear, we've seen companies that were incredibly aggressive doing it also through level 2 fair value gains. The third one, it's so hard to choose, but I'll go with related parties. So when you go to the related party transaction section, if you see a number of disclosures, I mean, one of our questions will always be, are there things that are not disclosed that should be that are related party transactions? But especially if we see a pattern, a number of these related party transactions disclosed, it's always a red flag, even if it seems small dollar, because it's never a good look. So if it's small dollar, you're wondering, well, why are you basically attracting attention to this over, you know, tiny amounts of money? And then obviously, if it's a big dollar amount, then it's, well, you know, really what controls were in place there? And how do we know you didn't just rip off the public company in a big way? So,
all right, let's go out on this. What is Carson Block's favorite investing term?
Okay, I'm going with novel. So it's not necessarily my favorite. My favorite would have to be getting level 3 fair value, but novel, HLBV accounting, that's hypothetical liquidation at book value. And this became relevant to us about 2 years ago when we shorted a company called Hannon Armstrong. But it's basically an obscure form of partnership accounting that becomes relevant with a lot of these renewable energy projects. And it's not normally something that's heavily manipulated because it's usually something that the project sponsor will utilize, and it's, you know, and it bears a relationship to the amount of cash that it realizes or that it receives. But where third party financing companies, these renewable projects, they can abuse it. And so Hannon Armstrong or HASI was one such company. So effectively, they were using HLBV to book non-cash income that will never be realized. That's basically equivalent, more or less, to the tax benefits that were used up by another party in these renewable partnerships. So it made their revenue and their earnings look good, but it was basically, it was entirely phantom. I mean, it was legal, and that's why I wanted to bring this one up. It's just a great example of how these ivory tower standards can be abused, but HLBV accounting.
Yeah, and you had me searching Investopedia to see if we had that term, and we do not. So now we need to create it, and we're going to give you the credit for it. Carson Block, the founder.
That was my mission.
Thank you.
That was my mission.
You succeeded. Fascinating conversation. Carson Block, the founder of Muddy Waters. Thanks so much for joining the Express.
Thank you.
It's terminology time. Time for us to get smart with the investing, finance, and econ term we need to know this week. And this week's term has to be stagflation. And no, that is not a bad Tom Hanks film from the 1980s that didn't age well. It is, according to the world's greatest investing education website, an economic cycle characterized by slow growth, high unemployment, and inflation. The GDP and inflation reports from last week that showed the severe slowdown in growth and sticky high prices had a lot of economists breaking out their stagflation costumes again. The only missing ingredient is a rise in unemployment. We haven't really seen that yet, as the labor market continues to defy a lot of the economic warnings we've seen over the past 18 months. But there's a reason people fear the stag. Periods of stagflation in the U.S., like from 1973 to 1982, lead to negative growth, declines in productivity, spikes in unemployment, and recessions, and it's no fun being a stock investor during those types of economic conditions.
Stagflation, the term, is generally attributed to Ian Macleod, a British Conservative Party politician who became the Chancellor of the Exchequer in 1970. He used the word in a 1965 speech to Parliament in what linguists like to call a portmanteau of stagnation and inflation to describe economic conditions at that time in the United Kingdom. Let's hope we stay stag-free as we navigate this tricky economic time. Thanks for joining us this week, as always, and special thanks to Carson Block of Muddy Waters for hopping on the Express. Short sellers usually like to keep to themselves, but Muddy Waters likes to make their research public, and we appreciate Carson for coming on the show. We'll link to Muddy Waters' research and all the reports we cited on this week's episode in the show notes. Find those wherever you ride the Express, and we'll talk again a little further on down the line.